Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Tres Hombres about their upcoming poetry reading, and we'll be talking about hidden treasures of the Galisteo Basin. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Carolyn Clark Beadle. She is the executive director of Assistance Dogs of the West, and Zoe Gibson joins us. She's youth board president and teaching assistant, and she's a sophomore at Desert Academy with Assistance Dogs of the West. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Mary Charlotte.
And, of course, this is on the occasion of the graduation, which is coming right up this Thursday, the 19th of May at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Convention Center. So Assistance Dogs of the West seems to be doing more and more stuff every year. You have, I mean, it used to be dogs could just open refrigerators and help you put your socks on and carry the groceries and things like that. Now they can do everything. Tell us about some of the programs that you do.
Oh, there are so many things that we are learning about what other jobs dogs might like to do, and we are learning how to engage them in doing those jobs. So as opposed to the beginning of Assistance Dogs of the West, when really they were focused on mobility issues, helping people, as you mentioned, with retrievals and opening and closing doors and lost items, etc. Lost items. St. Anthony? Sorry, I just had a moment.
So they can say, you can say to your Labrador Retriever, where was my left shoe? Where was that earring? Where was that book I was reading? The one about the mystery about the... And they get...
They know a lot more than you think they know. Okay, so they used to just pick things up. And now, because the state of New Mexico, which is served by Assistance Dogs of the West, all the people with disabilities in the state of New Mexico, come to Assistance Dogs of the West and say, hey, you know, I have this mobility challenge, but also I have a seizure disorder. Okay. Can dogs help with seizure alert and response?
And it turns out they can.
Indeed, they can.
How does that work?
You know what? I was afraid you were going to ask me that question because that's the one thing we really don't know. We being people involved with canine behavior and abilities and with the disability world, seizures are what they are, and there's a chemical and an electromagnetic difference that's occurring in the body, and we don't know if the dogs are merely sensing that from an awareness standpoint and a behavior recognition standpoint, or if they actually are recognizing a scent, because clearly there is some kind of chemical change that goes on within the individual that could emit an odor, but we don't really know.
Some dogs will naturally pick up on it more than others. We don't know how to start that training. We simply foster it when we see a dog responding to some of the symptoms.
And so you will have somebody who has a seizure disorder. You'll get a dog around him. You'll hang out until a seizure starts to happen?
Well, in effect, yes, not quite like that. But when clients are interviewing with us and they have a seizure disorder, they are interviewing with us over a period of time with a number of dogs because we're looking for the right match.
Yeah.
And obviously those things do occur with the individual when that's what their problem is. But I wanted to tell a story about a dog that had a seizure, that was working with a seizure disorder client that kind of explains the we don't really know. And one dog was placed with a young woman who had actually multiple seizure disability. And she was in the intensive care with cluster seizures. And her dog was with her, as was her mother. And the dog started to alert. And the mother ran out to the front or the nurse's station and said, my daughter's having seizures. And they are looking at all the monitors saying, no, she's not. Two cubicles down was a little boy who was having seizures. Okay, so dog does not know the little boy. Dog is not near looking at. So how does that happen? And that's the real, we don't know.
Yeah.
But as Zoe points out, we act on the interest that certain dogs demonstrate.
Now, another thing that the dogs can do is help people with post-traumatic stress disorder and other kind of psychiatric problems.
Right. You're asking what they do with that. Well,
they say, how do you feel about that?
Every morning, let's talk about how we feel. No, though they might in their own nonverbal way. What they're doing is a number of tasks as well as behaviors. And the task might be presenting a barrier between myself and the outside world, the world that's frightening to me. So there is a physical barrier presented by animal. Then that's a great thing. They also might carry medications if you had that requirement. But when you think about what you might be worried about from post-trauma, it might be the sounds, it might be the visuals, it might be that waking up in the middle of the night and the horror, which is still with me. If your dog is sitting there asleep on the bed next to you, you know darn well that's not real. So it helps with reality recognition. It helps with integration back into society because you can develop the relationship once again softly and gently with your dog, and that can generalize.
There's also, we've had a couple of times the folks from Horses for Heroes on the air, and they work with horses and post-traumatic veterans. And there's just something about being with an animal in itself, which I don't know, I don't think anybody understands exactly why that is, but it helps people.
Right, as Carolyn said, our dogs not only act as physical barriers to people who may be experiencing traumas with different aspects of the world, but they also act as these emotional barriers and help people with that. We have found, we also set dogs in courthouse situations where they can serve as companions to victims when they're out testifying. And we have found that because dogs don't require the same physical interactions as humans with the physical contact and with the emotional contact and even verbal contact, that a lot of people find it very comforting to be with this dog, a fuzzy animal that they can sit down and not have any expectations of them in terms of behaviors.
We're talking about the assistance dogs of the West. So there's dogs that help people with diabetes. Dogs can detect low and high blood sugar?
Exactly. And if you think that, or if you know that, dogs have 220 million scent receptors. Human beings have 5 million. There's a large exponential ability that is inherent to the dog. And when you think about, you know, taking a dog for a walk, and that's the excitement is the smells. That's what, you know, that's why dogs are off doing what they want to do, because they navigate the world initially through their sense of smell. So if they can observe or become aware of the particular scent, they obviously can be trained then to alert to it. All human beings with diabetes have the same odor emitted from them and the same scent in their saliva and in their sweat when they're going into high blood sugar or low blood sugar, the danger areas for people with diabetes. And dogs actually are proving to be more effective than even some of the glucometers and the technical tools for people with diabetes, because they get it actually earlier. The equipment is set to hit real danger. Dogs start to sense it even before that. It's like you're moving into it. Zoe, time to address the problem.
Amazing. So you, Zoe, are one of the trainers. Tell us about the process of learning to train assistance dogs.
Okay. I have been training now for almost 2 years and started with the Desert Academy in-school program. And subsequently have become a teacher's assistant and help out in an after-school class teaching younger students how to train dogs as well. It is quite an interesting process, and it greatly varies with the type of dog you're working with. We have dogs who are naturally more eager to ask for tasks. Dogs will say, give me something to do. How's this? Let me try this. And then some dogs who may need a little more motivation, a little more energy to get to work. And based
Gee,
on...
Gee, it sounds like people.
It's exactly like people.
No, we're not taking human students, Mary Charlotte. Okay, go on,
Zoe. We're not going to put humans on leashes.
I've seen humans on leashes. Have you ever seen
as
parents,
have
little
I,
kids,
yeah.
children on leashes?
I'm thinking also, you know, some. Well, never mind.
Okay. Anyway.
So it's quite interesting to adapt your learning styles and your expectations based on the dog and their work ethic as well as their age. We start dogs when they're itty-bitty teeny-tiny.
Like 10 weeks?
They come in at about 9 weeks, generally, and we start training then. A prominent thing we start with is the come game, where we'll get multiple people in a room, and you'll say the dog's name and come and treat them when they get to you. So it's name recognition, it's listening to commands, it's up and about, it's moving.
Do you get to name the dogs?
That's sort of an interesting process. We have some of our sort of larger donors will request to name a dog. And then when a new puppy comes in, that next name on the list may or may not go to that puppy. And then some of our prominent people will also get to name dogs. I know two student trainers who had worked with the program for a number of years, and they each had a puppy named after them.
Nice.
We collect names as recommendations. And Zoe kind of referenced the fact that the dog actually picks their name, because if they don't respond to the name that we want to use, even if that was top of the list, it has to wait.
Really?
Seriously.
So when you play this come game, you might say, come Zorro, and it doesn't want to, and then you say, come Superman, and they'll come?
Not necessarily. Generally, we will have a name set out before we even get to the point of the come game. Generally, the come game happens in classroom environments with other students, and so that at that point, as a training tool both for the dogs and for the students, we have one set name, so that there's little confusion
right.
and chaos sort of happening with...
So then they go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, imagine we work with students with developmental and cognitive disabilities. So if there was too wide a variety in that, the come game might turn into a festival.
Right.
Potentially
a little carnival.
A little carnival. Good idea. The idea of what students are learning at the same time, if the students with developmental disabilities might have a problem with sequencing, might have a problem with memory, might have a problem with focus, and that's a really simple game that's really helping the dogs learn, but is also helping the students.
Very interesting. So we're talking about the Assistance Dogs of the West. Okay, so then a little puppy learns its name, learns to come when it's called, gets mm-hmm. treats, and where do you go from there?
So from there we start building on commands. Generally, some of the first commands that will come in are sit down. Walking properly on a leash is a huge task that, depending on the dog, may take a fair amount of time to train. And then we just start building. We'll do unders under tables. We will have dogs retrieve items, open and close doors, put their head on our laps, all kinds of things. And so the caliber of training advances as the puppies advance in their age and in their training. Some puppies may only be able to take 4 minutes of training at one time before they need a break, before they're overwhelmed with what they're being asked to do.
Right.
So we have to sense that and we have to work with that in order to make them successful.
Now, occasionally, a dog will just flunk out of the program.
Nobody flunks. Mary Charlotte. No, they don't really flunk out of the program. What we are looking for, because all these dogs are going to work, they have a specific job. We talked earlier about the fact that all dogs probably want jobs, but this particular job of assistance dog work is very specific and has a certain set of behaviors and abilities that are required. So when dogs come into the program, we're looking at, we've already assessed them from a temperament and a health background standpoint, but we're looking for serious interest and, you know, continual interest in learning. If that's demonstrated not to be the case, we are also looking at what do they like to do. So we have some dogs that have stayed in the program. They didn't go out to clients, but they are training dogs because they work so well with students that are in the program. And they have different personalities, so they help the different kinds of students understand that all dogs are different and that here's these are dogs that still have an interest but really want to work with you. We have some dogs that that have a minor health issue that comes up, and they can't really go out and work with a person with a disability for the job, the intensity of the job that's being required. So those dogs sometimes are released. And we have a wait list of folks that are interested in our release dogs.
Because those are well-trained dogs
over
compared to, for example, my dogs.
Uh-huh. Trained in a different way, I would say. I mean, they are trained with a set of expectations. So these, and they've learned to learn. And Mary Charlotte, I think that's a really interesting point. The earlier that you start training your dog, the greater the ability is that it will be able to learn in the future. So that phrase, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, well, you can if it's been taught to learn
right
early on. If it hasn't, then it is difficult, and that's who created that little cliche.
So you've got library dogs.
Did you not read about that? It was actually in the Albuquerque Journal just recently. There is a dog that is working at St. John's College in the library. And so the head librarian there, Jennifer Sprague, had heard about the program, understood about it, and she really, really wanted to bring a dog into the St. John's College. Now, didn't you spend some time there?
Yes.
I think so. All right, so you probably have a very strong understanding of the environment, and there's a huge focus on learning and kind of an element of competition, I'm going to say. And it may be personal competition, but it is striving. And so what does that create in the environment? Some tension, I'm going to say. And
I think probably more, I was a graduate student there, and probably more among the undergraduates, we were just having a great time.
Well, good for you. But I do know that there's a lot of, and it probably is the undergraduate, you know, specifically. So Jennifer wanted to bring a dog in that had been trained to do service work, that was very highly interested in public access and also in socialization. And Seymour, a black lab, was placed with her, and she has the most astounding stories about what happens. Literally, there was one young man, and it is an undergraduate, who never spoke, who would come in there and just be intense. And we were laughing, saying, I don't think you're supposed to talk in a library, are you? Well, I guess you can talk to the librarian. He did not. For 2 years, he would come in and do these things and never speak to her. And the minute Seymour got there, he came in and started petting Seymour, getting that kind of calming influence that the animal can share, and he has conversations with the librarian. And she just uses that as an example, but a huge example of the impact that he's having, Seymour, the library dog, is having on the entire environment.
We're talking about Assistance Dogs of the West. Now, the graduation is this coming Thursday, the 19th of May, at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Convention Center. People can call tickets, or they can go to Tickets Santa Fe or assistancedogsofthewest.org. They can call the Lensic at 988-1234 for tickets. And is it fun?
It's always fun. It's always fun.
Lots of dogs?
Lots of dogs, lots of people. Demonstrations, students making speeches about dogs that are graduating.
Clients
t-shirts,
accepting their dogs.
T-shirts, raffle tickets, that
would be our youth board vice president representing. The youth board has a raffle every year, and the proceeds go to the Emergency Veterinary Fund for Assistance Dogs of the West, because our dogs frequently have issues.
As everybody does.
Yep. So we're currently selling tickets out in public, and tickets will also be available at graduation.
Oh,
excellent.
She's shameless. Okay.
it's good.
The other thing that happens at graduation is really when Zoe was talking about demonstrations, we have lots of our student trainers that are not the graduating student trainers do demonstrations. That the Cum Game, for example, is going to be demonstrated by the Santa Fe Boys and Girls Club after school kids. So it helps the audience understand the progression of training a dog, a number of the demonstrations.
All of this is happening this coming Thursday at the Convention Center, assistancedogsofthewest.org. Carolyn Clark Beadle, Executive Director, Zoe Gibson, Youth Board Vice President and Teaching Assistant, Dog Trainer, Zoe's at Desert Academy. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I will see you there. I'd like now to welcome to the program poets Tommy Archuleta and Christopher Johnson. They are two of the tres hombres, who will be reading their poetry on Thursday, May 19th at 6 in the evening at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mary.
So this Tres Hombres, how did this come together? Do the three of you work together as poets? Do you collaborate at all?
No. No, we don't collaborate. I think we're just three poets who wanted to have a reading, and one of us had a venue for it, being Phil, who's not here and works at Collected Works Bookstore, of course.
How did you find each other?
That's a good question. Well, I know Tommy and I met at school.
Mm-hmm. College of Santa Fe.
Where both of you studied.
That's correct, yeah, with Dana Levin.
Who was just on the show recently. And I guess she's quite an inspiring teacher.
Yeah, definitely. She's a very animated, often excited teacher. She's a great teacher. She's really excited about what she teaches, and I think when you're teaching, that's what counts the most. I mean, that's what gets other people to really get into it.
Is that when each of you started writing poetry, or have you been doing this all your lives?
No, I came late. I didn't start writing poems until 2001. Started to take it more seriously and then got enrolled at College of Santa Fe. And I entered there in the fall of 04. Actually, Chris was towards the end of his undergraduate courses there, and he was wrapping up. We didn't really start talking seriously about that until Chris had left. And then later on, when Dana and I moved from College of Santa Fe over to UNM, Chris took a workshop, and we started, you know, just Chris is now a local by default or whatever, and so he's a Santa Fean, and so we would drive down together or drive back, and we just had these conversations. I had known Phil for some years prior to 01 when I got in, you know, started writing poems, and then as we started, I don't know, just doing more readings around town and whatnot, Phil, being a poet himself and such a pivotal role at the Collective Works bookstore, he's like Dorothy's like sort of number one man. So
Dorothy Massey, the proprietor of Collective Works
exactly.
Bookstore, is wonderful and runs a great bookstore.
Yeah, she's very supportive of us, you know, up-and-comers, whatever, and literature in general. So she gave us a reading last summer, and that was the first Tres Hombres. And
was it the same three hombres?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay. And that would have been the fall, I believe.
And you also, Tommy, have been working on the Muse Times 2 poetry series, which is also there.
Exactly, yeah, that became the home. And that was a conversation that Dorothy had with Dana, I think a couple years ago. They were kicking around the idea of having a quote-unquote serious poetry reading there, a series. And later on, when I entered UNM MFA program, they were letting me do some independent study work, and we were finally able to, you know, coordinate this series together. And so partially it's for course credit. And in the end, I guess we ended up bringing some more poetry to Santa Fe as a result.
Tommy Archuleta, would you like to read one of your poems?
I can, sure, yeah. I was lucky enough to get this poem, which I actually started writing during my MFA program. I'm still there at UNM. This poem surfaced as a result of attending a reading that actually Dana was reading at the Church of Beethoven, this sort of very strange subculture of classical music adherents. And what they do is they invite poets to read, and they have poets read in between movements.
Yeah, it's amazing. They did one at El Museo, I think it was a year or two ago. It was quite a while ago, and they had a piece of, I think it was a quartet, a classical quartet in several movements, and Lisa Gill read poetry between the movements. I'd never seen movements broken up that way in music before, and it was fantastic.
Yeah, it was. I had never been there. I don't know if, Chris, if you've ever attended those readings or those performances. They're pretty amazing, and I had never been there. And they have a warehouse in the warehouse district in Albuquerque,
And yeah, I don't think they're doing it in Santa Fe anymore.
No, I know they have their own place. I had heard that they were going around and having performances elsewhere, but they're I'm sure they're still in existence.
So you wrote a poem called At the Church of Beethoven.
I did, and I was there in attendance with another colleague of mine, Nick DePascal, who's a great poet, and I've always been enamored of... I'm not being a father myself. A big part of the poem, its theme is fatherhood and my awe of fatherhood and the responsibility that that takes. And so somehow that seemed to be a theme that the poem kept wanting. And just recently I learned that the Pleiades, a fairly well-known journal here in the States, picked it up.
Nice.
And so I guess it'll be coming out sometime next year. These things always take a long time. So there is an epigraph that I stole and had wanted to put in a poem. I felt like it was a germ of a poem from Schopenhauer, one of my favorite philosophers. And he wrote extensively about aesthetics. And it was his belief that music was the purest form of all the art mediums. And so the poem begins with this epigraph from Schopenhauer, which says, "The other arts speak only of the shadow, but music of the essence." To join verse in powder wig music, this is our pole star, says the usher. Rough not to picture a lily in the hair of a cobbler's daughter lounging on the queen's bed, debooting. I merely ditched my beloved solitude to be here tonight, whereas my friend, the human resourcer, gave up dozing off in a second-hand armchair holding his newborn son. To us, anything for the work of a decent dark surgeon tailing Haydn's last quartet. I still smoke, so I can't smell the faint scent of his day's worries riding his shirt, commingling with that of the boys. That mixture of awe and panic, laced with day-old violets, new fathers know all too well. A lone flycatcher hops from rafter to rafter for what? A better view? Someone up front with the ahem and sniffs of a critic between threats. The anti-heart attack shoes and gown of our wandering hostess. The old man down the row from us, scolding his right hand's inability to open and close freely. What here doesn't point to a prime mover, gold with pleas for its fold? Set out for the essence of a thing, knowing failure awaits you, says the cello. Our shadows still mingling about the place, hats and capes in hand. A white moth wanders in off the street. The rest follow, and off we go to the sense of having Borealis here before. It took father a full year to even approach mother. Two, to learn how to walk directly into her eyes without tripping. Later, if not beneath the choir's first guitarist, you would have found me in the crying room, giving the altar boys the finger. Was that the birthplace of my beef with both ritual and tempered glass? Or was it out on the porch of the house in Pecos, looking into the kitchen, mother's mother, ordering God to move the cancer from grandfather's throat to hers? And this is what the nape of autumn's neck tastes like, says the oboe, to the vision of my friend's son at home, fast asleep on the living room floor, his lovely wife on the couch she settled for, frightened for the first time in her life at the certainty of nightfall. None of you, says the viola, save the child, of course, can imagine life without me, much less the orchard miles north of here, the pickers at ease amid bushels of choke cherries brooding over the day's take.
Tommy Archuleta. And once again, he and Christopher Johnson and Phil Geronimo will be reading on Thursday, the 19th of May, at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore, Tres Hombres. Christopher, would you like to read a poem?
Sure. I have one right here. This poem is called The Quick Orchids My Hopes Is. The quick orchids my hopes is. They flourish to their environments, and yet are fragile things, coveted. They itch like dogs' wounds, and swim like fish or flop for breath. They augment my consciousness and domineer my lungs and chest with leaves and rocks. They fall off for present feasts, available flesh, a sudden instance or new reference, painful defeats. They make days and nights unfaithful clocks that short, lag, and surge. Handfuls I have forgot, stratagems, eyes, names, came and went like matchsticks, others are pole stars, will some remind themselves to terrible dreams. By hopes I've been aspens, or coiled upon floors as rope is, withered and went dormant, but sands them, and I am only stone and dumb conduit, just accidents.
Christopher Johnson. I'm sorry that Phil's not here, Phil Geronimo, because he also has some excellent work to contribute, but they'll be reading on this coming Thursday night. Is there in your lives, the two of you here, a poetry scene that you are part of where you're feeding each other, where you're feeding each other's work and growing not only from your own reading and your own inner process, but from your interactions?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And I wouldn't limit that to just poetry, but so many people working on so many different things, whether it be poetry or prose or visual arts or performance arts.
You're part of Meow Wolf.
Yeah. And I don't know, there's just so much out there. And everyone has all this energy. It's really amazing, actually. And that all together, finding people that have a similar creative drive, no matter the medium, I think, really feeds into it and generates ideas. I mean, really good ideas aren't just limited to any one art form, I think. So, yeah. And, I mean, certainly, even on the poetry aspect, I think Lannan, the Lannan Foundation, does a lot for poetry. Collected Works Bookstore has really been a forum for poets, especially. I mean, because not many places want to have a lot of poetry readings these days, but Collected Works does want to have them, and I think they do very well by them, too. So that just tells you people are not only creating their own poetry, going back and forth with one another about poetry, but there's people who are interested in poetry, too.
Readers and audience.
Readers,
readers,
people who enjoy poetry, who aren't necessarily getting their hands dirty onto the paper. Yeah.
Tommy?
Well, being born and raised here, and I guess being a musician, I've been in that milieu, still am, and so, in this collaborative kind of mindset. And so,
What do you play?
Well, I'm a drummer. I've been a drummer for many, many years, and perform and record and all that. Mostly alternative, or what people years ago called punk music. I don't know what it's called now, but coming into being introduced to actually formally introduced to poetry. I mean, I think we all had our scrapes with poetry in school when we were young. I know I did, but I never really started delving into what it meant. You know, I had no idea that language could be that musical and that captivating and that mysterious. So what my love affair with it was late in life, and And then I could see pretty quickly, at least at College of Santa Fe, that those of us that were infected with this illness of writing poetry seemed to kind of, like, you know, we were sort of, it's such a, I mean, writing in general is such a solitary act that it was really nice to know there was other people that were as sick as I was with this thing. And Chris was one of them. And so, I don't know. I mean, I just knowing Chris is around the corner, you know, schlepping coffee over at Downtown Subscription, and I see him, like, you know, on his breaks, pulling out the very same notepad he has right now, working and crafting pieces. I mean, that...
You're going to get me in trouble now.
That knowing Chris, and when I run into him and when we have occasionally these readings, it's tremendously comforting for me. And I don't really go much for the whole Lennon thing. I think as I age, I find big deals more and more suspect. I rather prefer those of us that, I don't know, that are just doing this thing because we don't really have a choice, because we really enjoy it. And if people happen to like, even accidentally like what we do, I think that's a great thing. But I won't speak for Chris or Phil, but I get such tremendous enjoyment out of putting these things, for the most part, moving commas around. I don't know why it gives me a sense of purpose, but I don't want to lose that. And whether people like it or whether I get a book published or whatever, that would all be just as much icing as being offered the opportunity to read some work with some friends of mine at a really great independent bookstore. I'm not really out to make it. I don't really have high sights on becoming a great poet by any means. I just love doing it, and I enjoy teaching it, and I enjoy talking about it, mostly because it's really a lot easier than writing it. It's tremendously difficult to write. But I don't think you're doing it right if smoke isn't coming out of your ears and nostrils. And
is that your experience as well, Christopher?
You know, it used to be. I don't know anymore. Now I'm pretty methodical. I do tons of drafts, one after another in the same day, and it's a pretty calm, steady process. But, yeah, there was times when I tore up pieces of paper, threw them in the garbage bin, yelled names at myself. But those days have kind of gone. I try to write in the mornings now. Instead of later in the day when everything has gone south.
Tommy Archuleta and Christopher Johnson are two of the three hombres, tres hombres, along with Phil Geronimo, who will be reading their poetry on Thursday, the 19th of May at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
I'm delighted now to welcome back to the show Jan Willem Janssens. He is the executive director of Earthworks Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thank you.
So this coming weekend, this Sunday, you and others are putting together an event called Hidden Treasures of the Galisteo Basin, starting at 8:30 in the morning. What's it all about?
Well, this is basically a big celebration of multiple years of work of a group of people. First to name is, of course, Commonweal Conservancy, who is managing and developing a wonderful preserve area there in the Galisteo Basin Preserve.
And it's such an interesting project because it's both housing and wild land in that one big development.
That's right. And actually, at this moment, the focus is really on the wild lands. So the market, as you know, for development is a little down.
And, right.
If you have Ted Harrison in the future, then he can tell you more about all those details. But
yeah,
the focus for Commonweal right now is on connecting people to this beautiful landscape. And I think for them in the future, that will definitely expand beyond the 12,000, 13,000 acres of the Galisteo Basin Preserve, like it does for us at Earthworks Institute and our partners at the Santa Fe Conservation Trust, who are also with us in this endeavor.
So what will you be doing on Sunday?
Well, on Sunday, we're going to first celebrate and look at the wetlands that we've been preserving there for 3-4 years now.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we have wetlands in New Mexico.
Absolutely. We have lost maybe 80 or 90% of them, but in the Galisteo Basin, we have maybe 500 to 1,000 acres left, all in small pieces of maybe a tenth of an acre to several acres at a time. And Several of those are at the Galisteo Basin Preserve, and they serve for purposes of wildlife habitat, as a sponge to absorb stormwater, and just to enjoy, to really remember also that they supported a lot of people living there. And that is actually the second piece of our day celebration there on Sunday, where we're going to look at the history of people and how people lived and used that landscape.
How did people live and use that landscape?
Well,
when it had more wetlands?
Yeah, it is still, I think, part of a mystery. But the earlier people who lived there, I think the earliest traces of people are dating at least 1,000, if not 2,000 years back. Well, I think even more than that. I wouldn't even speak for the archaeologists who know much more.
Right.
But the most visible pieces of life there started around 1200. And so there are several traces of those peoples at the Galisteo Basin Preserve, especially around the Galisteo Springs area. And then another layer of occupation of about 50 in the 1500s and 1600s when the Spanish explorers came through the landscape. And they settled and had camps there in the center of the Galisteo Basin Preserve. An archaeologist that worked on the sites that we did erosion control work on found actually arrowheads from around 1600 there. And so that was really interesting. And the entire area that where these springs were, we discovered was most likely a campsite for people who traveled north and south between Santa Fe and settlements, Spanish settlements that were more to the south of Santa Fe. And actually, they came up from the south and started to explore in the area of the Galisteo Basin and all the way up to Santa Fe and Pecos between 1540 and 1580, 1600.
So when you do this walk and this whole event on Sunday, will you actually be pointing out kind of archaeological features, like where people were?
Several, yes. Actually, we're starting actually the morning with a presentation by Kurt Kempter, who is a geologist. And the Galisteo Basin Preserve is also a wonderful example of how the geological history of that land is visible today because of the multiple erosion levels that have exposed walls of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years of sedimentary depositions on top of each other.
So you can see layers, which are basically a kind of textbook geology lesson.
That's right. And so, and as a result of that, because of the different layers that hold water, we have the opportunity of springs in the Galisteo Basin Preserve and in the Galisteo Basin in general. And these springs, again, provided wetlands and even permanent flows of water through that landscape for thousands of years. And that is what made the occupation possible that we've seen in the last 700-800 years, and that was at such a height and activity between about 1250 and say 1750 or so. Yeah,
it's I think important to put yourself in different timescales, in the timescales of centuries and the timescales of millennia.
That's
as you
right.
get to do on that walk, because we normally kind of stay in our heads where the 80s were a long time ago.
Yes. Yeah, no, people will be challenged a little bit to stretch their imaginations from the scale of geological timescales to historical and prehistorical timescales. And so what the geology and the hydrogeology, so the water-related geology, means for people's opportunities to live in this landscape and what they have done and how that has, again, led to certain signs in the landscape, maybe erosion signs, that we can now read and then tell a story about how people lived there. And in turn, we therefore hope to convey the message how beautiful and wonderful this landscape still is and how careful we actually have to be with it for future generations, but also for wildlife that still lives around these places, because 70 to 80% of the wildlife species in our landscape depend on these wet places.
It's very important also to remember that there are just so many more of us people than there were even 100 years ago, much less in the 1600s and so on, and that the pressure that we put on wildlife and put on our own resources is just vast. We forget
that's right. And So it is so easy to just think, oh, this is a desert, and hey, there's nothing important there. Let's just build, or even if we cannot build because of, for whatever economic reasons, have cattle or a mine or whatever do there to extract the resources. And with that, often we forget how important a story there is hidden in the landscape about what is possible, what is not possible for the longevity of other species and ourselves. I often call the Galisteo Basin a land of paradox and promise, that a lot of people see a lot of promise there, and then later, after one or two generations, realize, like, oops, this landscape is a lot harsher in terms of the opportunities that it offers. And so you need to actually have a much larger landscape to derive your resources from, like the Native Americans did, who could travel around and benefit from four ecoregions within maybe 50 miles. But now, if you live there and your economy, like our day-to-day economy, is no longer based on roaming around and having alternative resources, then we really easily start to mine our water and our and whatever is there.
We're talking to Jan Willem Janssens. Now, on Sunday, Hidden Treasures of the Galisteo Basin, there will also be a chance for people to plant some trees.
That's right. So we still have a need to plant more vegetation, especially now that we have restored the Arroyo Los Angeles there and captured some water. Even in dry periods like now, you can still find some pockets of water several feet deep that seeps out of the walls, and that can support some plants. So if people are interested, and I must say the archaeology tour in the afternoon is already fully booked, and we're maintaining a waiting list. But for those who are interested in staying around the cowboy shack and the area where we have done some wetland restoration, they can, under the guide of John Busmeyer, our restoration ecologist, plant some trees and maybe learn more about the restoration work we've done there.
And the restoration work, I mean, Jan Willem, you've been at this for so long that restoration work that you did, say, 10 years ago is really bearing fruit.
That's right. So we started with small community meetings, and now that we've basically adopted, you could say, entire landscape of communities, the techniques that we pioneered 10, 15 years ago are now being used and applied on the ground, not so much to restore even that piece of land, but to mobilize people and their awareness about that landscape, and then connect them all together with other open space pieces, conservation easement areas, county open space areas, to create this long corridor or protected landscape that connects the Sangre de Cristos with, say, the Sandia Mountains for larger landscape connectivity.
And that connectivity has to do, among other things, with migrating wildlife.
Absolutely. Like, there is a lot of migration of bear, cougar, deer, and other species. So the bigger game species migrate within their lifetime. Other species migrate over generations. And that, especially now in times of climate change or fragmentation as a result of infrastructure, roads, homes, etc., it's important for these species to have, maybe within generations, an opportunity to move to different landscapes if the ecology is disrupted somewhere else, so that they can actually, as a species, survive and have enough genetic variability to mate with other species, that they stay...
Other individuals, yeah.
Other individuals, you're right. So that they stay really healthy as a species.
And it's important for us to remember that we share the earth with them. Jan Willem Janssens is the executive director of Earthworks Institute. And once again, Hidden Treasures of the Galisteo Basin begins this Sunday, the 22nd of May, starting at 8:30 in the morning. For more information, people can write to earthworksinstitute.org. They can also call 505-982-9806. Anything else before we go?
Yeah, people should register tomorrow. No, that is today, Wednesday, before 5 o'clock.
Today's the deadline?
Yeah, today's the deadline.
Okay.
At 5 o'clock today, so that we can at least order your lunch, or so that we know how many people are coming, because we expect many people this coming Sunday, and we'd like to know how many are coming in terms of parking, etc. Please go to our website and go to our events registration calendar, and then you can sign up if you want to come on Sunday.
Jan Willem, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Doubtfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.